Succession number 11939, row 10.
Mr. J. L. Williams, Rail 10. How were you received in Folkestone on returning from Dunkirk, Mr. Williams?
Well, as I say, after we'd arrived there, we had to get rid of our ammunition into a box. And then there was a guard, NCO, asked for our rifles. And I said, we're downright infantry and we don't hand our rifles over. We're taking our rifles with us. And they let us go through. I suppose they didn't want an argument. We went straight through onto a train.
Was there any civilian services there on the?
There must have been railway employees there, but we just got in the train, put our small kit on the rack and our rifles on the rack, and sat down with a sigh of relief. And the train was very quickly filled, and we puffed our way through to Ashford, in Kent. And when we got there, crowds of marvellous people. And some little girls from one of the local boarding schools. And they gave us food and apples and oranges and sandwiches and great cups of tea. And there was a stolid sort of, almost a BBC caricature of a fat village policeman going around giving us all a telegram form so we could send a telegram to our people to say we'd arrived safely. And we had to hand them back into them. And I remember some of these young, obviously, better class boarding school girls said, what was it like? And I said, well, it wasn't too bad. The only thing is I feel terribly dirty and unshaven. The dad said, oh, that's all right, Sergeant. My brother, he started to shave, and sometimes he looks worse than you. You don't look too bad at all. I said, well, thank you very much indeed. And all the people were saying, are you all right? And was it too bad? I said, well, no, not really, because I couldn't start giving it. And then we moved off and away through. And we went to sleep, and we couldn't know where we were going. The train shunted, and then we went here, there. And we finished up in Cardiff Station in South Wales. And we were taken off and put onto trucks and eventually arrived at a place which was between Cardiff and Barry Docks, a place called Wenvo Camp.
You say trucks, is this cattle trucks?
No. We put into vehicles, you know, three tonners. And from the station and driven out to this, and it was a big army training camp, obviously. It was extra canvas tents and so on. We were taken in and we were given a sandwich and a cup of tea. I forget what it was we were given. And then we were given a blanket and detailed to go. It was a lovely summer evening, but it was dark. You know, it was dark, it could be given blanket. And there was a marquee there with straw in it. Or hay or something of that nature. They said, go in there and have a good sleep, and when you're waking up, we'll tell you what to do. We went in there, and the Sergeant Major and I were like, oh God, isn't it marvellous, Sergeant Major said, and a lovely balmy sunny day. No noise of shelling, no noise of bombs and multiple machine guns and so on. And I went to sleep, and I must have slept like a log, because I suddenly was waking by a voice saying, Sergeant Williams, they're kicking the rib. And I jumped up to attention. It was a Sergeant Major standing. And he had an ice cream. And where we went, there was a bloody stop me and buy man just outside. We were just on the perimeter of this place. He said, you said you wanted a bloody ice cream, didn't you? I said, yes, Sergeant Major. Well, here it is. So the first thing I got to the morning in South Wales was a stop me and buy one ice cream.
What date would this be?
That would be... must have been 1st or 2nd of June. But I'm a little bit confused at that point, you know. But on theorising, it must have been about that.
What was the mood of the people around you? You were back in England. Were you getting any feelings as to the mood of the people?
No. The letters out of camp, after we got cleaned up and so on, the letters go out of camp. And I went out there and there were some men came and said, look, would you boys like to come to the Conservative Club at Barry Docks, have a drink with us? And we said, well, thank you very much indeed. We went along there, and everybody was shaking hands with us and saying, glad to see us. One or two old soldiers said, hell, in 1918, we ran back. We've never run as bloody far back as this. And we were laughing about it, so it was a joke, you know. And they were absolutely... We would have been absolutely alcoholics, so, and sandwiches and so on. And I always remember there was one old chap there with a battered sort of face and a bowler hat on, drinking a whiskey and leaning on his stick like that, looking at us in a very, what seemed to be, baleful sort of way. But all these other Welsh people were saying, come on now, boy, or have another drink, and that sort of thing. And this chap got up, finished his drink, got up, walked past us, and he said, you boys will not have too much money now, will you? Put a quid note on the counter, on the table between us, and went off. I said, well, you can always make mistakes, our major, can you? And then we went back to camp, and the next nonsensical thing was, we checked what we had. Now, we had our housewife, mess tin, that sort of thing, and a knife, fork and spoon, which we had in our small pack, because we still had our small pack, you see. And we were lined up in front of the quartermaster store, in a long line, irrespective of rank. And the first thing I saw, just about two in front of us, there was a... Because we still had our steel helmets and our caps, you know, which we all stuffed inside our fore and aft caps, you know. And there was this bloke, you know, dishing him out with a fore and aft cap. And this chap in a very pronounced Scottish accent said, I'm no having one of their bloody things. I want a bonnet. They said, well, we haven't got a bonnet down here. You take this hat, and when you get back to your depot, they'll give you a Scottish bonnet. He said, I'm no wearing one of those bloody things. This quartermaster said, now, you'll bloody well have one or you'll go in the guard room. He said, I'll go in the bloody guard room, but I'm no having one. So they marched him away. and then when we got a housewife, I said, just a minute, quartermaster, I have my housewife, I have my knife and fork and spoon. You're not, let my bloody, you're bloody well take them. So I got a double issue of these things. Talk about being wasteful, you know.
Were your uniforms replaced at this stage?
No, we still had the same uniforms. I suppose we'd be a bit battle-stained, but we'd sponge them off and clean them up, you know, and laid on our trousers and that sort of thing, you know, after we'd got ourselves established.
Did they take information as to who you were and where you'd come from with
them? I don't remember, but I think they must have, you know, because we told them we wanted to rejoin our battalion, and 9th Battalion, Durham Infantry, and 50th Division, and we then were moved up. In stages, the first thing, we went further up into Wales, and I just remember where precisely. And we were somewhere around about Shrewsbury way. And then they sent us up to Chester, where the castle is, and where there was a depot there. And the colour sergeant said, well, I'll have your rifles. I said, no, I'm not handing these rifles over. He said, you've got to hand them over. I said, I'm not bloody well handing none of these men here. And the Sergeant Major said, I'm not either. Well, these are our rifles. We're taking them back to our regiment. And I'll bring the officer to you, and I said, bring who bloody hell you like. And they brought a captain. He said, now then, what's the trouble, Sergeant? So I explained to him. I said, we're territorials of the Durham Infantry, and we're taking our rifles back to our people. He said, well, look, he said, I applaud your desire to do so, but he said, we are, in fact, he said, the country's in a bit of a spot, you know. He said, we're taking our rifles and redistributing them to other soldiers and also to people like home guards and so on, because, you know, this country's in a rather parlous condition. I shall give you my personal receipt and give your men, because it was still about Ian and I, say, your personal receipt for your rifles. Will that do you? Well, he'd explain it. So I said, okay, so I lost my rifle and the Cheshire Regiment depot, but I got a receipt for it, you know. And when I took it and showed it to the... Oh, hell, we don't bother about it. Half this lot... When I took it back to the regiment, the battalion said, oh, well, half these lot didn't manage to get off with their rifles, you know. So they had to come through off. So I'd been making a big song about something...
What kind of time scale are we talking about from Cardiff ultimately to Chester?
Well, I think it must have been 1, 2, 3... About 5 days up to Chester. And then shortly after Chester, we were back with the battalion. But, you know, the gap in my memory is I don't quite remember where I joined the battalion. But we joined them, reported to the adjutant, you know. and he asked us what where we'd been.
It wasn't in Durham County, was it?
I think it was in Durham County. I'm not quite sure whether it was, because I'm not quite sure it was, because we were given 3 days' leave, and we had to go on the train to the central station. So I'm not quite sure where it was. Because we've got
so you came back to the battalion, and were you given 3 days' leave immediately?
From the battalion, yes.
How did your family receive you?
Oh, we were very pleased to see it, you know.
Did they know you were coming?
No, no. Well, we got off the train on the London train side, and I always remember, whenever I go across that bridge, I remember it. Our company clerk had been a bloke called Private Jimmy Harrison, and his father was a porter at the central station. And as a sergeant major and I were coming across the thing, this old porter said, he said, read the book War Jimmy Kitt, because he knew the sergeant major. The sergeant major said, I'm sorry that it is. And put his arm around his shoulder, and this poor old chap burst out weeping, you know. And some other, you know, you get a little bit hardened at things like that. But I suddenly realised people had lost. You know, I'd seen French civilians lying dead. I'd seen some of our blokes lying dead. I'd seen wounded and so on. But it never struck me until this homely little character on the porter on the bridge over the railway at Newcastle. He said, read about War Jimmy Kitt, he said to the sergeant major. And I said, no, that's it. We got home. Happily, our people, they weren't on the south coast. But they hadn't seen the bombing and shelling and the pillars of smoke and so on. And so they were very vaguely unaware. They knew they'd been. We wondered whether you'd get out. I said, oh, yes, we were all right, no trouble at all, you know. I didn't go bothering to any detail.
No mood of disaster at all.
No. We went for a drink in the village, a few of us, you know, and again, some of these old 14, 18-year-olds said, Christ almighty, you moved rather swiftly, didn't you? In the March 1918 retreat, we didn't get as far back as that. We stayed in France, they said, you know. We took sort of half irony. But I don't think we were aware of the serious situation, you know. I don't really think we were. Incidentally, one minor point. Several times in the war, I found things happening in pairs to me, as but we tied up alongside a ship in Folkestone, as I told you. And when we had to cross the deck onto the quayside. And it was the prow we crossed over. That was the ship that took us from Southampton to Cherbourg, on our journey out. So I stepped out of England and I stepped back in England from the same ship. And that was it, we were there.
3 days leave, what did you do in the 3 days, in the brief time that you have? It wasn't very long.
Well, I had a jolly good bath and a wash, you know, and so on. And I don't know, we began to bask a little, you know. Oh, your back wasn't bad, you know. We began to think, oh, well, we must be heroes or something, you know. But I still had this feeling that I wouldn't have liked to tell people about the way in which some of these people were acting, you know. And I think I was a very heavy reader of Kipling and H. Rider Haggard and people like that. And I told you, when this officer collapsed and started shrieking out, we're all going to die, it's suicide and so on. In none of the books I read, British officers had ever done anything like that, you know. And I think I lost a little bit of faith, you know. I thought officers were something special that sort of stood up and said, right, lads, follow me. And here was this one, you know.
Speaking of faith, I think you intimated earlier on that you changed agnostic.
Yes, yes.
So that religious faith hadn't any great... It didn't... pull at all, gave you any great strength.
No, but I must tell you, or did I tell you, when the balloon went up, and I was very near this, these two dear old ladies in Alain-les-Marais, and I went across to see them, and flung around and I said, la guerre commence, Jean. And I said, yes, yes, indeed, it does, and so on. And they kissed me, tears in their eyes, and so on. And one of them put a chapelet, a rosary around my neck. And I said, you do know, mademoiselle, that I am not of your faith. He said, Jean, we spoke to the priest, and he said we had an English soldier who was very dear to us, and he wasn't of our faith, but would he bless this chapelet so we could give it to him? And the priest said, there may be several roads to the same bowl. I shall be very pleased. I shall bless this rosary for your sergeant. You may give it to him. Now, much later on, and the priest said the same thing to me again, but that, by the way, I said things worked in pairs. And I wore that thing till it fell off. It was just a cheap old black embroidery with a crucifix on, and whether I was agnostic or not. I always felt that it was done with such goodwill that I couldn't do anything but benefit from it. I didn't have strong feelings of religion or anything like that, you understand. But the kind of deed of these old ladies, who died during the war, during the second, the third time the Germans had been in their country, they died.
In your own small, closely knit group, obviously you were closely knit, was there feelings of religious beliefs that were strengthening any of them? Or?
No, there were one or two lads who were Roman Catholics, who did in fact kiss the cross, and you know. But I had the same rosary I was wearing, but I never sort of. But in the main, no, there was very, very little. There was sort of survival. Literally, there was more cheerfulness when I look back than one should have been allowed to expect. And it was a question of this, I think, really. We were all too bloody stupid to realise precisely what a spot we were in. And of course, we didn't feel. It was the old, old story. Our fathers had defeated the Germans. So why the hell should we worry about Germans? As I say, we took two prisoners on one of these things, and there were little young fellows, and their boots were worn through. They were walking practically on toes sticking out through their boots and so on. And they had no equipment or steel helmets on them because and their coats seemed to sag and so on. And I thought, oh, Germans, you know. We saw one or two prisoners coming through.
This was at Berg.
At Berg, you know. We saw some of the latter people came through. Some MPs once with two or three Germans, and they looked such sorry sort of individuals, you know. My first reaction was, I'll be quite honest with you, the hell are the bother of taking the Dunkirk? Well, why don't they just shoot them now? They'll be taking spaces up, and that was that, and. You see, on my radio, which is Nuffy radio, which I had, in addition to listening to music, I also heard part of that service I had, praying for the safety of our troops and so on. It didn't impress me. It's awful that they say this, but it didn't impress me particularly. I thought it sounded a lot of mumbo-jumbo. They wouldn't be shot at. They could all sort of chant very nicely in church and so on. And I'm afraid that sort of situation occurred time and time again, you know. And there it is. I must have been rather unfeeling. But one of the things I was happy about, and I certainly recommend, if ever a situation arises, try to become a lance corporal or a sergeant, at least, because then you have some responsibility and you have to think about other people. And that gives you a certain sort of shell, which you can sort the world, you know. And...
After you leave, where did you go then?
Now, we came back. We went back down. I think it was around about that time we went away back down to Lyme Regis, down in Dorset, but very far from Bridport, you know, and around that area there. And we were down there. We were certainly down there when the planes started coming over, you know, the fighting. Because where we were down there, there was a squadron of Poles fighters. And it was breathtaking. You see, along would come, especially people going on to bomb Bristol and so on. Great packs of German bombers. I don't know whether that's the correct term. With top cover, underneath cover, and side cover. And you see the alarm. You see this thundering lot coming out. They're nearly making the grass quiver with the noise. And suddenly up would come in line astern. A line of Polish fighters, straight up, and into the middle of the bombers. And the German fighters were milling round and round because they couldn't fire inwards, otherwise it'd hit their own. And bombers were falling down and so on. And it was almost like a boy's own story thing, you know. And it was down there once, again, I show how these things happen in two. I believe I mentioned when I was at Alain Les Marais that I was in the billet where Captain Ball's belongings were brought by these Saxon officers. Well, I was in a pub in Bridport once, having a drink. I'd got down there about lunchtime, and the siren went. And everybody drank and went out, except one little chap sitting with his stick in his hand, chap about 40 or so, 45. And he said, I'm not going to shelter, Sergeant. I said, I've bought this beer, I'm going to finish it. I said, I'll keep you company then. We sat down for a while. And then we took our beer in the hand, we went out and we saw these coming across. And he said, I wonder what my old skipper would make of all these. I said, who is your skipper? He said, well, I was a Royal Flying Corps. He said, I was a mechanic for Captain Ball. See, several times in my life, little things were knit together like that, you know. And I was lit. I also had another case of an association with Captain Ball later on in the war.
What were you doing down in Devon, Dorset area?
Well, we were getting a lot more training. A lot more hard training to make us fit, you know. And we were doing all sorts of exercises. And I think a bit of reality had entered into it. We also did a little bit of shooting. And it was around about that time when they began to get me giving gas instruction, which hitherto I hadn't bothered, you know. And
what was the weapon situation?
Well, we were
equipment.
We had all equipment which was entitled to have, you know.
It had been replaced.
We'd been replaced, those which were lost and so on. You can give me a new rifle for the one that's taken off me at Chester. I never felt so perturbed all my life, I might tell you, in retrospect. When I showed the receipt, and I wasn't at all impressed. I said, well, I did try to keep my rifle. Oh, hell, he said, don't bother about things like that. I thought, well, I should have thrown the bloody thing away at Dunkirk, you know. But, we were kitted out straight away, you know. And I saw a lot more sort of supporting arms, like artillery and that sort of thing, you know. I was taking part in exercises with the associated troops around there.
You were working more with other services?
With other services, you know. We sort of...
Were you still in the motorised role?
Well, I didn't become aware of that. That seemed to have disappeared. We were just infantry then, just ordinary infantry.
Were you on the coastline?
We were on the coast, yes, yes.
And Lyme what were you Regis, doing with regard to coastal defences?
We did nothing except we had where we had posts, we had Bren guns, you know, and we had them manned all the time, ready for.
Was there anything new in the form of weapons that was reaching you?
No. We just had the same old rifles and Bren guns, anti-tank rifle. Sort of thing. But I think a lot, you see, we were just infantry company. But I rather think that round about that time, looking back, that headquarters must have got some extra mortars and some anti-tank guns, 6-pounder anti-tank guns, you know. And
were you still in the same company?
Yes.
What about the commanding officers? Have they changed?
Well, yes, we had Colonel Percy. Mm-hmm. And I should mention as well that when I was in France, when we won an exercise, once one of our exercises, I was taken by Colonel Simpson up to see General Martel. And then only I realised it was a look at me because I was being put in for a commission.
This was in France?
In France.
Stage.
Yes. And when I got back to England... my company commander told me all papers had been lost and that I'd have to go through the thing again. So if we'd been in France a bit longer, possibly I might have been returned to England, to Octio. As it was, I didn't go to Octio until April 1941, you know, 6 months later. But, nearly 7 months later. But I was just carrying on as an ordinary.
Where were you billeted? And what were the conditions that you were billeted in?
We were billeted, again, in sort of church halls and places, and it was just the same. We had palliasses and blankets on the floor. Still didn't have beds or anything like that. And that was quite... No civilian. We weren't billeted with civilians, you understand. We were in church halls and school halls and so on, as platoons and as companies and so on. And discipline was very strict, you know. It had to be. But strange enough, I didn't have any contact very much contact with the civilians. I met this little chap who said he'd been a mechanic. Everybody seemed to be going about their own business. Now, a few months later, when we got down to, you know, Devon Cornwall, people were very friendly there, and we really got to know individuals, you know, but there was nothing much doing down at Bridport. Looking back again, with back of hindsight, I suspect the people were now beginning to get a bit shocked. I mean, every day there were great quantities of bombers flying over on the way to Bristol and on those parts, you know, and a lot of machine gunning. They were too far away to do these sort of lightning raids such as we had later on in Folkestone, but there were quite a lot of heavy bomber raids. And of course these old Poles were really tearing into them. First time I realised what hatred could do, you know, these Poles had sacrificed lives as they had to. They went straight line astern, straight into the German bombers.
Were there any invasion scares that you had to deal
with? No invasion scares at all. But the suggestion was, you know, that, again, when I look back, if you look at the map, Lime Bay is quite a good landing place. So the possibility was they were covering the possibility of a landing place. You know, after all, a limited number of places in which the enemy could have landed along the south coast. Landing any force needed a fairly big bay or a landing place. And I suspect that we were there. And in a left-handed sort of way, it must have been a bit of a compliment, because they must have looked upon us as sufficiently battle-hardened troops to deal with the... And I never saw any regular troops there.
You must have had replacements for your losses. Where were they coming from?
Well, I think they were coming from... I don't know whether Bransworth was in operation then, but we were getting them from the Durham Light Infantry Depot. I suppose originally some Fenham Barracks was where the Durham Light Infantry Depot was, you know. We got a lot of militiamen and people like that who joined us. We certainly weren't volunteer territorials by that stage. In France we had militia lads, you know, joined us.
Were they all Durham men that were coming to replacements?
At that stage, quite a few. And then we got a bunch of Cockneys, real EastEnders, you know. And then we got an infiltration of one or two light infantrymen from the Shropshire Light Infantry. And they were light infantry regiments. But how these Cockneys, how they could... You see, there was the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, there was the Oxenbuck's Light Infantry, and there was the... but these were definitely EastEnders. Good lads, they were as hard as nails and tough as could be. And, you know, full of themselves. Oh, what the hell are you blokes talking about? How the hell do you understand each other? You know, that sort of thing. When our lads were talking in broad Tyneside and so on, you know. But,
you mentioned training, more route marches and toughening up exercises. Were there any indication to you at this time that in the way in which training was changing because of the experiences of France?
Not really. I don't know, I think it was just we were made into tougher soldiers physically, you know, and it was an advantage, I suppose, having been shot at, because you wouldn't blink so much if you were shot at again. I suspect that was one of the reasons we were down in this coastal area, because I suppose if there were any battle-hardened troops in the area, there must have been people like 51st Highland and 50 Div and some of the regular troops. But I know there were no regular troops. We were all territorials along that particular part.
When you came together with the battalion again, obviously most of them had been fighting through the retreat.
Yes.
What was the morale like in those early days back in England?
It didn't seem to change at all. We lost people, you know. One of the people killed. Some had obviously been taken prisoner, you know. Although they were missing, so they'd be taken prisoners. But it wasn't the... There was a strange sort of belief that if the letters had another go, we'd do better next time, you know.
You were looking forward to it?
It was all based on our ignorant belief that we were superior to the Germans. There was this temporary sort of aberration when we'd been pushed out of France. But there was a sort of slight suggestion there. Well, of course, it was the bloody French weren't any good. You couldn't rely upon them. Which was a sort of a, what shall I say, we were trying to excuse ourselves, you know. But we all had tales to tell about these Belgians and French and so on who were running away and not fighting and that sort of thing, you know. And It was.
Was there any indication that the men has felt that their own officers had led them well during this heavy time, this hard time?
I've never heard anything of that nature, any suggestion against that. No, I never heard anything like that. Captain Wood, you know, he was still our company commander. And no, I never heard anything of that nature, you know. It doesn't come to mind, and I'm sure I would have remembered it if it had been so. There were one or two cases when one or two NCOs whom we knew, there were one or two who'd been a little bit jittery under bombing and that sort of thing. But if anything, they were spoken of rather kind-heartedly, you know.
Were these NCOs still with you at this
stage? Some were, and some were in hospital, you know. And some of them were sent away later on, you know. They found other jobs for them, obviously, which were of a slightly less competent nature, you know.